Sunstones, Brian Buchanan, and Lindsay Hanson Park bring you this limited mini-series, The History of Mormon History. Welcome to Deseret Dramas Season 2.
In today's adventure, we make economic history great again. Brigham Young doesn't need Nicoderm, thank you very much. And grouchy knights dismantle Camelot. All this and more in Chapter 4. Chapter 4. Stop playing with your little history factory. The rise and fall of Camelot.
Following the end of World War II, one of the returning officers had decided he wanted to research 19th century Mormon history. He made an appointment with John Widstow. Given his background in the academic world, he felt like this particular apostle would be more sympathetic to his plans than, say, church historian Joseph Fielding Smith. You gentle listeners will recall from last chapter why this was a good bet. So this young veteran sat down in John Widstow's office, and Widstow kindly detailed how this young scholar could scheme his way into the sources he wanted. Quote, "Let me give you some practical advice. Now don't go in there and say, 'I want everything you have on Mormon economic enterprises.' You go in there and tell them you're interested in studying Mormon culture and Mormon history. Begin by asking for some printed books about Mormon history. Doesn't matter if you've seen them before or not. Ask for some printed books. Spend a day or two looking at them. Then ask for some old newspapers. They'll bring them out to you, and you'll look at them for 2 or 3 days. Then ask them what their basic source of material on Mormon history is. Now they'll say, 'The Journal History of the Church.' You'll say, 'May I look at the first volume?' They'll bring it to you, and you'll use that. When you finish that, go back and get the second volume, the third volume, and stay there until you finish the Journal History of the Church. Considering things like they are in the church archives, you have to be like the camel which poked his head in the tent and gradually moved along until gradually it carried the tent away with it." Who was this young scholar? None other than Leonard J. Arrington himself.
Leonard listened up, followed the John Widstow program for success, and soon was able to look at pretty much anything he wanted. A very bizarre quote-unquote interview with Joseph Fielding Smith gave him essentially carte blanche at the historian's office, and he was off and running. He spent 4 summers poring over the Journal History, which is a massive collection of scrapbooks that chronicles Mormon history pretty much day by day. Now bookmark that little detail of spending 4 summers for Chapter 6, would you? After years of painstaking research in 1952, Leonard sits down at his typewriter and pounds out his dissertation, all 449 pages of it, in the space of just 10 weeks. Pretty impressive. 6 years later, it's published by Harvard University Press as Great Basin Kingdom. Now, you look at the subtitle, An Economic History of the Latter-day Saints, and you might be tempted to back away slowly from me without breaking eye contact. Now, come on, man. We've been through 3 chapters together. Trust me when I say this book is phenomenal. It's very, very interesting. I've been told by multiple grad students that it still actually gets assigned as reading for the comprehensive exams. And if you consider the conditions in which he wrote it, and you bookmark that right, it's even more impressive.
Now hold on, sir. You just hold right on. Yes, Great Basin Kingdom is, in fact, really great. But we need to back up to the mythical year of 1950. If anyone is going to get credit for kicking off the so-called New Mormon History, it's the little historian that could. Penn Levitt's boy herself, the badass of Bunkerville, Juanita Brooks. Sure, Arrington had to figure out how to outsmart Will Lund in the archives. That's no small feat. But come on, economic history versus perhaps the most controversial event in Mormon history, the Mountain Meadows Massacre? Juanita had to research this happy little episode while fighting stereotypes about women in history, oh, and also being a mom to a bundle of kids, and riding the bus from St. George back and forth to the archives when her groundbreaking and candid history of the massacre was published by Stanford University Press in 1950. It signaled a change in things. Not only were historians going to tackle touchy subjects, They were going to do it with better sources and candor, so take that, A. Will Lund.
And it wasn't just the LDS faces coming to this party. The RLDS faces out there in the Midwest were showing up, too. In 1965, Robert Flanders publishes The History of Nauvoo, a period which had always been controversial in the RLDS Church. He even, clutch your pearls now, admitted that Joseph Smith was a polygamist. And while this ever-increasing trickle of new histories was being published, things at the LDS Historical Department were pretty much the same. Grouchy Will Lunds trying to protect the kingdom. But then, two related developments come together to spark a massive sea change. Except, you know, it was on land, but whatever. In 1970, Joseph Fielding Smith was forced to admit he probably shouldn't try to be church president and also church historian. So Howard W. Hunter, who we mentioned last chapter, he'd been an apostle for 11 years, is now appointed as the new church historian. He was a sharp guy. He'd been a really successful lawyer in California before he got called into the quorum. And maybe because of that, he realized what he wasn't, a historian. Well, this might, you know, seem obvious to you listening now, this wasn't a given at that point, not at all. Church historians had been church leaders pretending to be historians ever since there had been church historians.
Hunter had a very simple but revolutionary idea. What if, and now stay with me here, what if, now just hold on, what if we let historians, you know, do history? Wild idea, right? Because what did that even mean to these guys? Developing actual policies rather than flowcharts like, does Will Lund like you? Yes? Cool. Go look at stuff in the archives. No? GTFO. Hiring professionals to be archivists and such who could be more helpful for folks coming in to do research. When historians came in, let them see things. So rather than just being hoarders, Hunter felt that the archives should be a functioning place. You have a legitimate research interest? Great. Here's the stuff. Make it happen, Captain. This trend had been slowly developing since the mid-60s, thanks in large part to First Presidency Counselor N. Eldon Tanner, apparently, and Hunter just kicked it up to 11. Mike Quinn tells a great story about being there one day reading through the Heber J. Grant diaries, which, incidentally, are 100% not available today, and this is another bookmark for later, while the non-Mormon dude next to him was looking through First Presidency files from the 1880s. Quinn noted, "This is how open it was."
The other development? In 1971, the LDS Church commissioned this big, wide-ranging study of their administrative and bureaucratic structure by a professional consulting firm. Their report strongly suggested that church leaders needed to be pulled away from their many other duties so they could concentrate on their roles as spiritual leaders and policymakers. One of the results of this study, which was taken seriously, was that Howard Hunter was released and Leonard Arrington was named the new church historian. And Hunter had actually been doing some proactive moves behind the scenes. So a year earlier, he'd called in five guys to talk about the possibility of having a professional historian serve as assistant church historian. And three dudes from that meeting actually would come on board. Leonard Arrington, as well as Jim Allen and Davis Bitten as assistant church historians.
So they quickly begin hiring staff, kicking off a period later fondly remembered as the Camelot era. Over the next decade, the folks that would wander in and out would become some of the key figures in shaping Mormon history. Mike Quinn, Bill Hartley, Ron Esplin, Carol Cornwall Madsen, Peggy Fletcher Stack, Glenn Leonard, Dean Jesse, John Sillitoe, and so on. One of the most obvious changes from previous regimes in the archives was the idea that they needed to be writing history, not just collecting stuff. Even on the collecting side, they made great advances. Mike Quinn tells this incredible story of poking around in the basement and finding a mountain of boxes that had apparently sat untouched since being moved there. Never cataloged and forgotten. Can you imagine? Leonard's team had ambitious ideas. Articles in church magazines, as well as academic journals that were both approachable but solid. And books, too. Goodness, yes, books. The feeling was that essentials in church history essentially sucked and needed to be replaced, not just updated every few years like they'd been doing. Leonard Arrington really believed that church history was a gift to the people, and he wanted to help get it out there. Eventually, two one-volume histories were published, The Story of Latter-day Saints, a more traditional chronological history aimed more at LDS readers, and The Mormon Experience, a book that took more of a topical approach that would engage a non-Mormon audience, too. Both of these histories went through a very complicated path to publication. Hold on to that thought for just a hot second. But they paled in comparison to the grand jewel in Leonard's plan, a 16-volume comprehensive history that would tell the broad panorama of the Mormon story.
You all remember the tale of Camelot, right? It was constantly interrupted by all the bloody singing of tunes like the fish slapping song and Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
And always look on the bright side of life.
Wait, that's Spamlot. Sorry, strike that. The actual Camelot, except there wasn't an actual Camelot, fell apart because the Knights of the Round Table had differing ideas on how to do things. The Arrington Camelot suffered from this too, only the knights were dudes like Sir Benson and Sir Packer, and instead of swords, they wielded words like communism and apostasy. There were three major book-related duels, and they would eventually poison the air in Camelot.
Let's give these grouchy knights some credit. They began complaining with the very first book by Leonard Arrington's team. Arrington had begun in a weird place with the grouchiest of all knights, Sir Boyd Packer. 2 months after Arrington had presented his master plan to the apostles in their weekly meeting, Leonard had an interview with Packer, who went into, quote, odd story mode. He told Arrington of listening to a CAS guy who mentioned some sticky wicket in Mormon history. Packer, of course, then went back mentally to elementary school when he saw a picture in one of his school books of a sculpture from ancient times that had no head or arms. So he tells Arrington this story. He tells Arrington that the sculpture with no head and arms was just like the LDS church, quote, pointing out that despite the weaknesses and shortcomings, the defects, the headless and armless condition, the church was still a great divine institution created through divine auspices. Okay, you figure at this point in the interview, Leonard is checking out the door, wondering if he could make a break for it.
All right, back to books here. In 1974, Dean Jesse, who you have to know could not be a more loyal company man, publishes an edited collection entitled Letters of Brigham Young to His Sons. It kicks off the famous Mormon Heritage series of books, which you're undoubtedly familiar with. You're not. Oh, right. This is not only the first in the series, it was the only in the series. Here's why. 3 days after the book is released, Packer fires off a letter, not to Dean Jesse or even Arrington, but to the First Presidency. I'm guessing Packer was the kind of kid in elementary school who went straight to the principal if another kid accidentally stepped on the creepy fortress he was building on the playground. In this 4-page letter, Packer outlined his 3 main gripes. First, one of Brigham Young's billion kids developed a morphine addiction after it had been prescribed to him. Second, Young had written a letter to his son on a mission in which he mentioned he also had used tobacco, but he'd kicked the habit and the missionary son could too. And then third, the book dared to mention that there was some trouble settling the Brigham Young estate after his death. These are your gripes? Seriously, dude?
If you're thinking, geez, there has to be something more to it, something more substantive. Substantive. Yes, of course. Packer tipped his hand in the letter. He warned, quote, "What concerns me about the historian's office is that, unless I am mistaken, the direction they are taking is to judge what should be good for the church and for the operation of the historical department against the rules set for historians. I have lived in academic circles." It's like Packer doesn't know how to deal with hard things. He goes on to say, "I have lived in academic circles, have observed the tendencies of highly schooled church members, have seen how perversely such information as this is often used, and wonder if these projects ought to be carefully reviewed before they continue." It's like a PhD picked on him when he was a kid or something. First, let's just dismiss one myth. I have lived in academic circles. Okay, calm down, brain boy. Packer was a career CES guy, so I wouldn't really call that academic. Let's just call back our judges from the last chapter. They rule to a big nope. Packer never really got scholarship. It's evident in how he responded to it. It was just a big scary monster in his closet. So historians were trying to judge what would be good for the church. Aha, we're getting warmer. Packer was an apostle, Leonard J. As his biography makes clear, he was a watchman on the tower. He knows what is good for people, not you eggheads. That's the job of the apostles, not some sniveling academic. Interesting side note, Packer happened to be one of the newest apostles, having been in the quorum for just 4 years. Super green, super new. So for dudes who reportedly eat chocolates in order of seniority, this is a serious talking out of turn. The book had already been approved by the First Presidency Packer was writing to. He had no oversight of the history division. He was just angry. The last sentence that I read to you in that quote was the one that likely concerned Leonard the most. The threat of having non-historian apostles nitpicking their manuscripts and telling them to faith promote them up. To historian, doing something like that is violence.
So the tempest blew over, but 2 years later, Packer tagged Ezra Taft Benson into the ring. In between yelling about how Martin Luther King was a communist plant, Benson somehow found time to get after the historians, too. The new one-volume history, Story of the Latter-day Saints, was published in 1976 by Deseret Book. In the preface, the authors, who again, super loyal guys, declared their belief that the church was divinely inspired, and then noted that it, quote, was always influenced to some degree by the events of the world around it. We think it important to see the institution in the context of its environment, and where appropriate, we have tried to demonstrate that relationship, close quote. Seems reasonable, no? Actually, no. Speedy sales, great reviews from basically everyone, couldn't change the minds of the Packers, the Bensons, and the Petersons. Fun tangent, some little pinko commie rag named Sunstone, which had been founded a year earlier, reviewed the book and noted that, quote, for too long, the LDS Church has weathered the charge that it would not voluntarily endure objective scrutiny. But this one volume by two prominent LDS historians goes a long way toward refuting that charge, close quote. So beginning with this chapter of the miniseries, it gets really fun because we know these people. The fact that this book and these authors could somehow be seen as subversive goes beyond hilarious to scary. If Jim Allen and Glenn Leonard are your boogeymen, your parameters very clearly need to be reset.
A sad pattern was beginning to develop. Apparently, Ezra Taft Benson himself didn't actually start out hating Story of the Latter-day Saints. Someone else helpfully prepared a list and one-up Boyd Packer, whose letter was only 4 pages, and this time it was 9 pages. Would you like a taste of this nonsense? Of course you do. Here's a quote. Allen and Leonard mention the coming of the seagulls to swallow the crickets without saying the Lord caused the seagulls to come and eat the crickets, end quote. As Leonard Arrington's biographer notes, quote, this would have been comical had it not served as the catalyst for the fierce backlash against Story. The thing is, another apostle, David B. Haight, actually read the book himself and quite liked it and told Leonard Arrington to keep up the good work. So why was there a problem? Easy. Benson and Packer types were so much louder than the David B. Haights in the Quorum of the Twelve. You know the old saying, the squeaky wheel gets the Camelot shut down. Wah, wah. Or something like that.
The longest, most complicated, and undoubtedly the most frustrating fight for Arrington regarded his massive new comprehensive history project. As proposed initially, and approved at several junctures by the First Presidency, that was in all caps in case you couldn't hear, it was going to be a 15-volume set written by folks that Arrington felt were at the top of their game in their field. A few things morphed, some authors and topics changed, and it becomes a 16-volume set. Now, humor me for just a minute. Listen to the scope of what Arrington envisioned. First, Introduction and Background, 1830, written by Richard Bushman, The Ohio Experience, 1838, by Milt Backman, Missouri Experience, 1839, by Max Parkin, Illinois Period, T. Edgar Lyon, Crossing of the Plains, by Reed Durham, Early Pioneer Period, Gene Campbell, Later Pioneer Period, Chaz Peterson, Early 20th Century, Tom Alexander, The Church from 1930 to 1950, Richard Cowan, Contemporary Church, 1950 to 1980, Jim Allen, History of the Latter-day Saints in Europe, Douglas Tobler, History of the Latter-day Saints in Asia and the Pacific, Lanny Bridge, History of the Latter-day Saints in Mexico, Central and South America, Lamont Tullis. History of the Expansion of the Faith, George Ellsworth. Then, A Social and Cultural History of the Church, 1830 to 1900, by Davis Bitton. And finally, A Social and Cultural History of the Church, 1901 to 1972, John L. Sorensen. Seriously, this was an ambitious project.
Well, this was a different discussion here. This was an aggressive plan involving a lot of books, and it scared those grouchy knights. So many questions were raised. Would Correlation read and possibly censor these? Does the church publish these, or does Deseret Book? Would these be used as textbooks? Would the authors get paid a lump sum or royalties? And if royalties, doesn't it suck for the dudes writing the less popular book? Wait, these guys are getting paid way too much. Can't they just write these as a church calling? And on and on and on. The worst thing was that Leonard got to answer all of these every year or so, over and over, each time as though it was the first time anyone had heard of the project. Seriously, it got to where they had to have minutes of previous meetings on hand so Leonard could basically point to them and say, yes, holy crap, they were authorized by the First Presidency, and can we all calm down and do history?
Talks about what to pay the authors went all over the place. At one point, they were talking giving each author $25,000, which, for a Mormon book in the 1970s, was actually a crap load of money. Talks got ugly. At one point, Gordon Hinckley has the legal department try and figure out if the church could wiggle out of their contracts with the authors. They couldn't. Finally, they decided to settle on a buyout, and Leonard's grand plan died a gross, contentious death. Now, if some of the books in the list I shared earlier sounded familiar, good for you, you're correct. The authors were then left free to publish elsewhere, and just over half of these planned volumes did actually come out, published everywhere from Deseret Book to university presses. And they hold a place of honor on my bookshelves. Since I forced Lindsay to endure a library tour with some of our friends at my house, she knows how nerdily true this is. Now, interestingly, the first book in this series also seemed to attract the most opposition. So that was the introduction and the background 1830 by Richard Bushman. So later, he goes back after it's published by University of Illinois Press, and then in 2005, it's published as Rough Stone Rolling.
These book-related fights and so many other things begin to turn the tide against Arrington and company, and Camelot, frankly. Spencer Kimball, church president during most of this, liked Arrington and even supported what the history division was doing. But remember those squeaky wheels? The voices of Benson and Packer ruled the day. Kimball also had a lot of other things going on, and it seemed like how to write history was super low on the priority list. Then, in 1977, 100 years after Brigham Young's death, and 5 years after Leonard Arrington was called as church historian, newly appointed general authority Homer Durham was brought in as managing director of the history division, with the express responsibility of babysitting these trouble-causing historians, or, you know, just historians. Arrington was initially happy about Durham's call, but after just a month of working with him, Leonard was hip to the situation. Things were a-changing, and not for the better.
Arrington's diaries, which are just an absolute treasure trove, show how even this eternal optimist was slowly beaten down. Part of it was Leonard didn't know how to play the game at church headquarters. As one of his colleagues, Ross Peterson, put it, quote, there was a side of Leonard that, I think, at that stage of his life and earlier, was a bit naive. He felt good history would stand on its own merits, and he felt the process of encouraging people to do history and to do it well would stand on its own merits, close quote. And this status quo train, powered by what Lindsay likes to call heritage history, required a lot of time and a lot of effort to turn, and it wouldn't happen during Leonard's tenure.
The decision was finally made to move Leonard's crew lock, stock, and barrel down to BYU. Honestly, it seemed like the plan was intended to make things as good as possible for Arrington and his colleagues, but it really was a demoralizing development, zero question about it. It's like in early church history, when a church leader was a troublemaker, you'd send him on a mission. Same thing, but they sent him down south to BYU. In 1982, marking a decade since Leonard was called, an event that heralded a new era, all of them were transplanted south to BYU. In a move that seems impossible to be anything less than a stern rebuke, the new organization was named the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Church History. You know, the guy who wanted everything nice and neat without hints about coloring outside the lines and probably bad history. Yeah, him. Make sure the history you produce is the kind he liked to read. Man, is it just me or did it get colder in here? Sure hope that end of Camelot didn't have a chilling effect on the writing of Mormon history. Next time in Chapter 5.
This series was written by Brian Buchanan, co-hosted by Lindsay Hansen Park, co-produced by Sunstone and Laurel Smith Steele. If you like what you hear, please consider a donation at sunstone.org.